Every second, lightning strikes our planet 100 times. The fires it starts were gifts from the sky for the first humans to walk the Earth.
Fire is the primitive image of human cohesion.
To harness fire, to master it, to own it. This need set the tempo for the progress of mankind. Fire has enabled us to heat, cook, light, melt, forge, hoist, and propel. It was instrumental in each of our conquests. From the first prehistoric fireplaces.
That's how you make fire like a Neanderthal.
To the hearths of the first metal workers.
There you go.
From the first steam engines.
We had engines that soon surpassed several thousand horsepower, unprecedented levels of power.
To the flames of the future. A voyage through time to explore thousands of years of history, which made human beings the masters of fire. On the point of Finisterre, just below a coastal path, protected from the eyes of hikers, is an archaeological treasure almost 500,000 years old. Here, deep in the sediment of Brittany, lies proof of prehistoric man's use of fire.
There's a lot more material here. Look, there's more charcoal appearing.
Yes.
At this level, which dates from 465,000 years ago, it would be good to scrape out some samples for study.
In this ancient cave, during 30 years of painstaking digs, more than 150,000 samples of charcoal, flint, and bone fragments have been collected. A priceless deposit, unique in the world, preserved by chance by a geological accident.
All we can see now of this coastal cave is just a small entrance, a shelter under the rock. You can just see the beginning of the roof of the cave. The roof went much further back, and the cave was occupied by humans. The roof was supported by a central pillar, which we think collapsed during a seismic event, gradually taking the roof with it and leaving these big blocks, which we find here and there. The large size of the blocks sealed off the archaeological levels, protecting them from the high tides and erosion. This is why we have these preserved ancient levels. It's likely that we don't have many sites this old in France and elsewhere in the world because they eroded over time and simply vanished.
Ménez Dregon, a dozen or so square meters known worldwide for the irrefutable proof of the use of fire by prehistoric man.
There are still pieces of scorched flint. You can see them very clearly. Flint changes color with heat to a kind of concrete color. And the inside structure became kind of gridded, which shows that the flint was split by the heat of fire. That's further proof of the use of fire here at Ménez Dregon. You can also see it in the reaction of the rock. Here, you can see the rock turn pink, which shows the presence of fire. It heated it enough for it to change the color and the internal structure. These traces of fire can't be accidental. They're clearly man-made. This localized change of color means that the stone was exposed to a very strong local source of heat. And to reach such a high heat, the fire was certainly controlled. That's what proves that man built fires in the cave and that they weren't natural fires. We found a hearth, a man-made fire pit, with scorched sediment on its surface, and pieces of charcoal of various sizes, shards of scorched flint, and some bones, the remains of a barbecue, maybe. The first barbecue in Brittany, 465,000 years ago. So it was also a social place. The hearth became the place that united the group. You can imagine the human group with families and children all living together, cooking together, growing up, hunting, making objects. It was a real living space. I personally find it very touching, imagining the daily occupations of the families that lived here 465,000 years ago.
The clearest symbol of fire for mankind is the hearth. But the flame also gave rise to the torch and the possibility for individuals to leave the group and venture beyond the usual limits, perhaps deeper into caves, to travel by night, to enter dark forests. So there's a notion of autonomy that came with the torch, of individual lighting, if you like.
The control of fire was a favorable factor for the settling of areas in Northern Europe. Once man had mastered fire, he could live in lower temperatures, gain in comfort, and had more geographic territory to explore, because he was no longer a prisoner of clement climatic conditions.
To be the perfect master of fire, man still needed to be able to light them himself. Among the thousands of objects found at Ménez Drégon, none have been identified as being able to ignite a flame.
To light a fire, you can use a bow drill as part of the fire triangle, which is made up of a combustible, an oxidizing agent, and heat to ignite the flame. The combustible is our plank of wood, which will provide the heat. The friction of the drill head on the wood provides sufficient heat, and the oxygen in the air will allow the ignition of the very first embers. Once you have the embers, you must keep them alight by blowing. Why do you blow? Simply to bring a sufficient amount of oxygen contained in the air to maintain and intensify this first combustion.
The bow drill was made of wood and cord made from vines. Materials that don't stand the test of time. Unlike flintstones, which have survived for thousands and thousands of years, they are ideal investigative objects in a very special discipline, experimental archaeology.
Experimental archaeology is a way for archaeologists to get a window into the past and how people behaved back then. So I've been making fire now using flint and pyrite for a good 10 years for my research. There's a common misconception that you can create fire by striking two pieces of flint together, but that actually doesn't work. When you do strike two pieces of flint, you will see a flash of light, but that's all it is. It's just a cold spark. And so you can't really use that to make fire. So you really need this pyrite, a mineral that can be found in the landscape that's comprised of iron and sulfur. And these combination of elements allow, when struck, this to produce sparks. And that's what you're using to make your fire. So what we do is we create experimental tools that resemble what you find from the archaeological record.
Andrew Sorensen's research has brought him to Pateau Shelter in the Dordogne region in France. This site, discovered by accident on a farm in the late 19th century, has given up a rich collection of prehistoric tools attesting to the presence of old Stone Age man. But no archaeologist has ever been able to use them to prove that Homo sapiens were able to light a fire at the time. To do so, Andrew Sorensen is using a microscope to compare his own experimental tools with the thousands of samples produced by the digs.
Within that zone of polish, you're going to see all these oriented striations, these scratches into the surface of the flint that look almost identical to what I can reproduce experimentally with pyrite for fire making. So based on the similarity of the traces, we can infer that this tool was used to make fire 40,000 years ago.
To deepen his understanding of the early use of fire, the American archaeologist is exploring the traces of a mineral that's widespread in the area, manganese. His investigation takes him to Roc de Marsal, a rock shelter that became world famous when the skeleton of a Neanderthal child was discovered there in 1961.
Here we have the classic deposits of Roc de Marsal, where the child's skeleton was found. Just at the bottom of this depression here.
So over here.
Yes, just between the two, yes.
On the floor of the cave, so on the bedrock here, you see a number of these sort of reddened patches over here and over here. And so I suppose that's corresponding to hearths that were lit during the earliest occupation of the cave in layer 9, right?
Yes, certainly. One of the specificities of Roc de Marsal is its density of hearths. In 10 square meters of digs, 25 hearths. If we start digging the remaining area over there, we'll probably reach 80 to 100 hearths, which is a massive number. All this shows the repetitive use of hearths here at Roc de Marsal.
Okay, so with all this evidence for fire use by Neanderthals in the site, is there any sort of evidence that that they were perhaps producing their fires?
No, so far we haven't found evidence to prove they made their own fire. But we have found a piece of unbroken pyrite, and we have two pieces of manganese with strike marks on them. And manganese doesn't exist around Roc de Marsal.
Okay, so the Neanderthals would have had to brought that into the cave. It doesn't occur naturally in the host rock here.
No.
So we know that they were bringing it here for some reason.
One major hypothesis is that Neanderthal man used manganese as a pigment for body painting. But another possibility, explored by Andrew Sorensen, is that of a combustion accelerator, a kind of prehistoric fire lighter.
So I'm going to use my biface, and I'm going to start scraping the amadou, which is this mushroom right here. It grows on trees. Once I get a fair amount, I will make two piles, one with manganese and one without. And we'll see which one works better at capturing the spark. See which one goes faster. Let's see. That should be good. And then what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna take my piece of manganese and I'm going to scrape it using the biface again, which is our multi-tool. It's sort of the Neanderthal Swiss Army knife. It's good for everything. Here we go, try it out.
After a few minutes of effort,
don't know why it's not taken. Okay. That one was hard fought. But it's going. Got a nice little ember here. I kind of lost count after a while, but I mean, this one was a bit tough. It might be the humid air tonight, but I mean, it was certainly, I would say, well over 200. This one took a little bit of effort, but hopefully the manganese will make it a lot faster and make the process a whole lot easier. Going. So that was noticeably faster. I'm not exactly sure how many that was, but probably more like 50. So it seems to, it's just one experiment, but it hopefully shows that manganese does make this process quite a bit quicker. Ah, woo! And that's how you make fire like a Neanderthal. Huh.
When heated, manganese releases oxygen, which facilitates and amplifies combustion. Although Neanderthal man didn't have the scientific explanation for this phenomenon, experimentation and experience taught him the interest in using this mineral. An extra tool which could be the sign of an already advanced control of fire.
You know, we're never going to find the earliest instance of this practice. All we can do is sort of chase it backwards in time. And it's humbling. It's also exciting. It kind of makes you feel powerful to be able to create a fire out of nothing, like inanimate objects that have nothing to do with fire on their own, but when they combine, it's like, you know, it's like one of the first syntheses that humans managed to create, is taking these two things to create something completely different. Everybody likes to gather around the barbecue. Everybody likes to sit next to a campfire or a fire in their fireplace at home. And I think this has a lot to do with the deep prehistory of fire use by people. It's sort of ingrained into our nature. We've incorporated into our psyche. And all of that can be traced back to the first person who figured out that striking a piece of flint with a piece of pyrite is going to create that spark. And not only did it sort of spark a fire, but it sparked our humanity in some way.
A driver of human progress, the control of fire produced a whole host of technological advances. Fire enabled all kinds of transformations: raw to cooked, clay to pottery, sand to glass. This all-powerful ally took man out of the Stone Age and into the Bronze, then Iron Ages.
The first metals worked by man were those that required fairly low fusion temperatures. It was quite possible to reach these temperatures by blowing strongly on a simple hearth. After that, to work iron and steel, it was impossible to reach the required temperatures of plus 1,300 degrees in a typical wood-fired hearth. Such heat could only be reached in a furnace. So the invention of the furnace was a genuine technological revolution.
Deep in the Burgundy region, a forest bears the traces of this revolution. A landscape made up of rocks that look like lava. And yet, there are no volcanoes around here. This strange landscape wasn't formed by nature, but by an ancestral human activity. 2,000 years ago, the Ferrier de Tanner was the biggest metalworking center in Roman Gaul. Blacksmiths constructed a large number of bloomeries, which could produce unprecedented temperatures.
They're changing color.
Did you fill in all the cracks?
Sure. And I added some clay and slurry. Even on the inside, where the heat cracked it. It's in perfect working order.
Wrought iron craftsmen, or simple iron enthusiasts, the members of the Ferrier de Tanner Association are trying to revive the technology of the bloomery. A smelting furnace which extracts the precious iron from rock to provide the blacksmith with the raw material for his craft.
It's ancestral technology. We don't know when it dates from, as there are no written records, but we have traces here from Gallo-Roman times. Iron workers discovered this thanks to potters who used the surrounding rock for their kilns, including copper ore. And they soon realized that as the temperature increased, copper droplets would fall onto their pottery. So they had the idea of doing the same thing with iron ore.
A bloomery is a clay pit and chimney, inside which a fire is lit. Once the temperature has risen, it's fed during several hours with successive layers of charcoal and iron ore. As this gradually descends the stack, the charcoal and iron ore heat up until reaching a temperature of 1,150 degrees Celsius, thanks to a constant supply of oxygen through pipes called tuyères. The carbon monoxide released by the combustion of the charcoal removes the oxygen from the ore, allowing iron to collect at the bottom in a spongy mass called a bloom.
This is our 15th bloomery, and we still haven't mastered the technique. With each new bloomery, we changed a parameter or two. We're getting results which are improving as we go along. We hope we get there one day. It's not certain, but we hope so. We will get a result, that's for sure. I don't know what result, but there will be a result.
To make the bloomery operational, you start by firing it on the outside to harden the clay and force out any air pockets. It's then left to increase in temperature all night long. A vigil haunted by the ghosts of the masters of fire, the blacksmiths of bygone days.
There's one figure who stands out, an almost magical being, and that's the blacksmith. The blacksmith was the one who, thanks to fire, could extract iron, reveal its secrets, and produced incredibly precious things. On the scale of a small village community, the blacksmith was the one who held that vast power. There are clearly mythological resonances in someone capable of doing such things. It was as if he were inhabited by powerful gods like Vulcan or Hephaestus.
Swords, armor, shields, knives, bells, cauldrons, locks, scythes. All the tools of civilization were struck by the blacksmith's hammer. At daybreak, to amplify the increase in temperature, the bloomery is fed charcoal, almost pure carbon. It will burn away with barely a flame, thus increasing its heating power,
I think you can feed it. I add some more to the charcoal. This is Burgundy hematite, which is quite rich in iron. It's a nice-looking red ore with hints of brown. And the richer an iron hematite is, it will be a darker brown or even gray.
Well then,
look! Look, we're nearing the bloom stage. It's nice and soft. It's very good sponge iron. It's not bad at all. It's really not bad at all. The temperature inside is 1,150 degrees Celsius, what we call the forging zone. It's when the metal can agglomerate and become malleable. If the temperature were higher than that, the metal would vanish, because it melts away at 1,400 degrees, and we'd lose it all. And if the temperature is lower than that, the metal wouldn't be malleable. But I wouldn't say we've completely mastered it, because we're still experimenting. We're able to control the fire, but we're still far from being alchemists or magicians. We're just some guys experimenting to try to rediscover the ancestral practices that have sadly been lost over time.
During 12 hours, 50 kilos of charcoal and 20 kilos of iron ore will be swallowed up by the bloomery before the blacksmiths of Tanair finally bring down the beast.
Drum roll! Stand back a bit. And there's the bloom. There you go.
But does the bloom contain the hoped-for iron? The magnet will tell all.
I have no reaction in these parts. Nothing doing there. Hey, this holds. You can hear the attraction. Here too, the magnet holds. There's iron in there, that's for sure. So it's a small victory. Because for 3 years, the magnet hasn't done a thing. The trouble is, the droplets of molten iron are spread about. So we've slightly missed out on getting one solid malleable lump. But it's good. It's pretty satisfying. I hope to one day unlock the secret of the Gallo-Romans. Sadly, they're not here to pass it on. But we'll keep going, and I'm confident.
Down the centuries, blacksmiths increased their know-how until finally inventing a new tool in the late Middle Ages, the blast furnace.
The invention of the blast furnace was made possible by greater air input from huge bellows activated by water mills. This extra air intensified the flames, and the furnace could reach extremely high temperatures.
Extremely high temperatures, which allowed man to approach the fusion point of iron. An almighty fire, which took us into the industrial era. Still today, the blast furnaces forge the world, from the tiny to the giant, from the daily to the extraordinary. Both a simple teaspoon and the largest ocean liner are both born from the molten iron of the blast furnace. In Pont-à-Mousson, the cradle of French steelmaking, beneath a 60-meter tall stack, foundry workers are busy collecting pig iron, an alloy of iron and carbon.
The first time you enter a blast furnace, you know you need to be brave to work there, as the pig iron comes out at about 1,450 degrees Celsius. You need to do the job to realize what the conditions are like, but you never really adapt to the heat. We have special gaiters, coats, and hoods, which reflect a maximum amount of heat and make things a few degrees cooler. And whenever we can, we leave the hot zones to cool our bodies down.
A furious fire, which exhausts not just the men, but the colossus in which they work.
Water constantly runs down from above just to cool the installation. Because with a massive amount of heat generated inside, despite the fire bricks that protect it, we need water to cool and protect the shoring.
A key player in global industry, the blast furnace fascinates as much as it intimidates those who witness its incredible powers.
I never get bored. I've been at the blast furnace for 6 years and I'm still captivated. We still come every day to watch the molten iron flowing out. You can't help but be moved by such a sight.
In man's quest to unravel the mysteries of the world, fire long held on to its secrets. For millennia, know-how preceded knowledge. Technology came before science. Man used fire without understanding it. In the late 17th century, German chemists tried to establish the theoretical basics of combustion.
One of the theories proposed to explain combustion was the phlogiston theory. It was believed that a fire-like element called phlogiston was contained in combustible bodies and was released into the air during combustion.
Phlogistos in ancient Greek means flammable. A phlogiston was thought to be a fluid that determined the level of flammability or not. If something didn't burn, it contained no phlogiston. If it did burn, it contained phlogiston. Sulfur, for example, is totally self-consuming, so sulfur was considered to be pure phlogiston, and alchemy rested on four main bodies, including sulfur, so this theory was coherent with other understandings.
Despite its coherency, the phlogiston theory would be challenged by French chemist Antoine Lavoisier. After studying a component of air, which he named oxygen, he carried out a decisive experiment in the history of chemistry. Using a precise set of weights and interconnected bell jars, he showed that the mass remained invariable between the start and end of combustion. Thus, the burned material didn't vanish, but was merely transformed.
This went totally against the phlogiston theory, which claimed that matter was lost and therefore no longer existed. So in the end, Lavoisier was right when he stated, "Nothing is lost, nothing is created, everything is transformed."
This statement would make Lavoisier the godfather of modern chemistry. Chemistry which would allow man to make fire whenever he wanted with a matchstick. Fire at your fingertips. A simple magic trick in appearance, but in fact, rather complex. The perfect recipe was developed in Sweden in the 19th century. The country turned matches into a world-renowned industry, relying on its vast forests, which still today supply the factories that make this proud national product.
This is Swedish aspen, and aspen is a very good fabric. So that's why we're just using the aspen. In one tree, you can make 1 million splints.
A 100 million matches, exported to more than 80 countries, leave this centenarian factory every day.
It's 150 degrees paraffin, and it is just to, for the splint or the wood to suck it up in the wood. It's helping the match to have a stable flame or a controlled flame. We are dipping the wood so they get their heads on the match. This mixture, it's very important that it has the right weight, because if it's getting lighter, then it's more flammable, the match. And if it's heavier weight, then it's harder to get a fire on the match. This is the moment where we have a deviation on the mixture. The mixture weight is too low, and we have to act fast because it's more flammable right now. Unfortunately, I can't tell you how much the weight is right now, or our definition when it's too low, because it's a secret.
A secret inherited from Swedish chemist Gustav Erik Pasch, who in 1844 solved the problem that the match had faced since its invention.
The match proved extremely useful, but was soon seen as dangerous because you only needed to strike the match head on any surface to light it. That's why they developed the safety match, by separating the two components, with one on the head and the other on the matchbox. So it's only when you strike the head on the striking surface that the two components come together and create the heat and sparks needed to light the head of the match and produce a flame.
The match, a tiny tool making fire available to all, anytime, any place, anywhere. While fire formed and transformed the world, it also set it in motion through the invisible energy contained in puffs of steam. A formidable source of power for engineers.
In the history of mankind, one of the first mentions of using steam to drive something mechanically is Hero of Alexandria. Hero of Alexandria was a real star of antiquity, a kind of Leonardo da Vinci of antiquity, who used to put on big shows. He invented a system to open temple doors using fire that was made on the sacrificial altar. When the fire died out at the end of the show, the doors automatically closed again, with pressurized steam and water that filled buckets, the weight of which pulled down the ropes attached to the doors. After Hero of Alexandria, there was a long wait before the next steam-driven machines, in the late 17th, early 18th centuries.
The Industrial Revolution marked a break. It came like a second domestication of fire, a reinvention of its powers.
The development of industry brought increasing needs for heat, and notably coal-fueled. When you want coal, you have to dig mines, and there's often water seepage. So your next problem is how to get this water out of the mine. A British engineer, Thomas Newcomen, had the brilliant idea of using steam to pump the water out of the mines. How did it work?
He filled a large vat with water and boiled it to produce steam. This steam rose into a cylinder, which allowed atmospheric pressure to push the piston back into the cylinder. Then he pulverized cold water into the cylinder. This cold water condensed the steam. The condensed steam occupied less volume than the steam in gaseous form, so it created a partial vacuum. And then the atmospheric pressure would push the piston again, which in turn activated a balance that worked the pump down in the mine. There's a famous painting of Newcomen's engine. It's in the background, with a few horses and donkeys in the foreground. This represents the driving power of Newcomen's engine, which was equivalent to the power of 5 or 6 horses. So horsepower became one of the first units of power introduced, as it allowed you to describe your machine to customers. Early engineers had this idea of comparing the power of their machines to the power that a horse could supply in 24 hours, union-based rest time and feeding time included. And so they would turn up and say, okay, you need 5 or 6 horses to do this work. My machine can do the same work on its own.
Despite being revolutionary, Newcomen's atmospheric engine had the usual defects of pioneer machines. Too rudimentary and too high in fuel consumption for too low a yield. Having carefully studied the engine, a Scottish engineer made such fundamental improvements that the international unit of power was named after him, the Watt. James Watt was a genius. In Wiltshire, on the Bristol-London Canal, a building is home to one of his extraordinary inventions. This pumping station, designed to feed the canal with water, still looks dashing despite its 200 years. Although an electric pump has taken over daily duties, on a few weekends a year, a group of enthusiasts keep the flame alight.
The 1812 engine is the oldest fully operational beam engine able to do the job for which it was originally designed. 200 years old and it's still here and it's still fully functioning. And we're part of it. That's fantastic. You can't get that anywhere else. So yeah, we enjoy it. The fire is never the same. It's a skill and an art to fire a boiler. You've got to be able to plan where you want the boiler pressure to be at a given time, given the variations in outside temperature, wind direction, so many variables in it. So it was a thing that attracted me. And if you can do it well, then it's a very satisfying job to do.
I'm feeling to see how much of a bed there is at the back of a fire. So it feels and it sounds like it's all burnt through. You can hear metal scraping on metal. So what I need to do is push the fire towards the back. So this one needs to be fueling.
To improve the efficiency of your electric pressure cooker, some engineers had the bright idea of putting little steel tubes in the water inside to increase the surfaces of exchange. And that significantly improved hot water production. And that's exactly the setup at Crofton Pumping Station, a boiler with two large tubular hearths in the water.
This is showing the exact position of water across the entire width. If the level gets too low, you start generating steam too fast, and it's harder to keep it under control. If the level gets far too low, so below this level, you can put the boiler potentially in danger because there's not enough water to cool it down, and you could potentially have a catastrophic event. Level's getting too high. They've stopped pumping, so the pressure is rising. Now we need to try and cool it down a bit.
Remember that at the time there wasn't soldering, and boilers were assembled with steel sheets riveted together. It's already incredible that they managed to make watertight boilers in that way. And there was no stainless steel back then, so boilers rusted quite quickly. One bar of pressure is 10 tons per square meter. At 10 bars, you're at 100 tons of effort per square meter of rusting sheet metal held together by little rivets. So that's a powerful bomb just waiting to blow up. To reduce the risk, Denis Papin came up with a brilliant invention, the safety valve, which gets rid of pressure when there's too much of it for the boiler. It's the same safety valve you have on your pressure cooker. This is a crucial feature that prevents the boiler from exploding. There were lots of accidents in the 19th century with exploding boilers. They made spectacular bombs.
You always, always respect a boiler, you respect the fire. Yeah. You don't want to argue with it. Yeah, so be its master, but you've got to be careful, certainly.
Fire is a very ambivalent source of power. You must never think of fire as a tool. Fire is not a tool, because a tool depends on you to work it. If you stop banging with a hammer, the hammer stops moving. Fire has a life of its own. It's independent. And so there's a big risk of fire.
Fire, both friend and foe to man, as terrifying as it is fascinating.
The use of fire to drive machines has allowed mankind to attain unprecedented levels of power. We soon had machines that were producing 3,000 to 4,000 horsepower. 3,000 to 4,000 horses made up for the entire French cavalry at the Battle of Waterloo, as described by Victor Hugo in Les Misérables. So totally unprecedented levels of power.
Soon, the formidable power of fire would allow man to crisscross the globe at impressive speeds. Fire on the rails, sending steam monsters across the plains. The fire of the combustion engine, propelling the first automobiles along roads and projecting the first planes into the skies. The fire of reaction engines, breaking the sound barrier, sending the first man into space.
We would reach gigantic levels of power and temperature. The fire obtained in the combustion chambers of rocket engines are of an incredible intensity. To give you an idea, take the Saturn V rocket. As it nears the end of its stage one propulsion, it produces a flame longer than its own length. The Saturn V is 100 to 120 meters long, and the flame is 150 to 200 meters long. So the useful power is equivalent to that produced by 100 nuclear power plants. So when you manage to get a rocket off the ground, you truly are a master of fire.
The notion of being the master of fire is ancestral wisdom. We have an old saying that goes, "Fire is a good servant and a bad master." We must become masters of fire, because if ever fire were to be the master of our fate, then all is lost. Everything would be consumed, and our race would die out. It's a question of power. It's a question of giving ourselves up to power and ever more destructive energy uses and power levels. On the contrary, we need to return to the wisdom of Prometheus and be able to accomplish all we can with the least amount of power and establish a new balance.
Today, more than ever, combustion is essential to human activities, providing 85% of the primary energy used in the world. But its role in global warming and restrictions placed on fossil fuel energies are pushing researchers to explore in their laboratories new, more virtuous flames like hydrogen.
Okay, the methane flame is stable. Goggles on. Side, would you open the laser shutter?
Using a laser, David Honoré and his team are studying the heart of a flame with precision and without disturbing it. Its stability, its temperature, and its various components. In their sights, one of the most used flames in the world, that of methane, the main component of natural gas, for which they are looking for a less polluting substitute.
One of the problems with methane flames is the presence of carbon. The products of combustion are water vapor and also carbon dioxide, one of the gases responsible for global warming. So we want to reduce CO2 emissions by shifting to decarbonized fuels, like hydrogen, for example. Okay, let's switch to 50% hydrogen. The flame is stabilizing with 50% hydrogen conditions. Now switch to the hydrogen flame. In the hydrogen flame, we no longer have soot emissions or radically carbonized emissions. Basically, we have practically only steam brought to a very high temperature in the flame.
The hydrogen flame and all its promises. We will certainly need to master it completely. A new conquest for fire, crucial and still in early development.
The fascinating thing after so many millennia of fire use is the complexity that remains regarding combustion. So we're still far away from being the complete masters of fire.